This is 2RPH. I'm Jolyon Warwick-James, and you're listening to the Antiques Radio Show, bringing you a monthly kaleidoscope of things old, beautiful, or both, whether valuable or not. Henry Ford, the car manufacturer, once famously stated, "History is bunk." I happily disagree. The philosopher, Georg Wilhelm Hegel, who lived from 1770 to 1831, stated, "What experience and history teach us is this, that people and governments never have learned anything from history or acted on principles derived from it." I sadly have to at least partially agree. But for the next half hour, we will try on the Antiques Radio Show to demonstrate how rich and informative history can be, as seen through objects, items, and works of art. We have some magic, some music, and some dinky little tax dodges. We move on to the question of provenance and how important it is to establishing authenticity or falsehood. We find a hidden story in an article. We go Chinese and ring some bells. All will be unravelled if you stay tuned. We start off with our first piece of magic, a hairy story from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 23rd of May about an item with quite a tale to it and a detailed provenance. And it's entitled "Platt Expectations Exceeded." But Platt is spelt P-L-A-I-T and is probably a pun on the title of the Charles Dickens novel Great Expectations. Platt Expectations Exceeded. The American magician William Ellsworth Robinson not only adopted the stage name of Chung Ling Su, but stayed in character as a Chinese magician on and off stage. A Chinese embroidered coat worn by him to be offered for sale by Van Helm in Cologne on May 25th featured in last week's issue. Across the Atlantic, another distinctive Chung Ling Su stage prop surfaced in the Potter and Potter sale of May 2nd, Magic Auction, where it achieved one of the highest prices. The Chicago auction house was offering one of Robinson's hair pieces, a flesh-coloured cloth skull cap on which is attached a human hair plait, measuring almost a yard in length, dating from circa 1915. Robinson met a tragic end when his bullet-catching trick misfired on stage. This wig was acquired by the performer Eric Mason, the great Masoni, at a sale of Robinson's, that's Sue's, personal property in 1920. The hairpiece was then obtained from Mason by the Irish magician Billy McComb and given by McComb to John Fisher. Offered at Potter and Potter with an estimate of $3,000 to $6,000, it ended up selling for the equivalent of about 15,000 Australian dollars all up. And now for some more magic, something a little more vocal, from the same Antique Trade Gazette of the 25th of May. Doll highly spoken of. The sale held by Swan Fine Art in Tetsworth on May the 6th included this fine-quality ventriloquist doll of circa 1930. Although not stamped, it shares the characteristic of figures made by the revered maker Arthur Quisto, 1882 to 1960, real name Edwin Sims, who built figures for a number of well-known music hall performers. He was the first to use electromagnetic devices to animate his figures, as well as a carved wood torso. The face, hands and feet are moulded papier-mâché, and the hair probably human. Appealing to collectors of decorative objects and collectibles, it sold for £1,500 to a buyer using the saleroom.com, way above the £60 to £80 estimate. Whilst we often wonder who is actually mouthing the words at song festivals and political rallies, we don't see too many ventriloquists these days, or their dolls. Thank you, ATG, for our two doses of magic. And now to more noise-making from a more easily identifiable source. We all know the sound of bagpipes. This set went into battle. And this comes on the Antique Trade Gazette of the 25th of May. into battle armed with bagpipes. As the Scottish regiments went over the top on July 1, 1916, the fateful first day of the Somme, they were led into battle by the wail of bagpipes. Despite the inspiration of such stirring sounds, pipers and soldiers alike were among the nearly 20,000 British troops killed on that day. That grim toll included Private William Alexander Scott of the Tyneside Scottish 21st Battalion Northumberland Fusiliers, who is commemorated on the Thiepval Memorial in France. The 21st Battalion suffered 131 dead that day. An original set of pipes believed to have been recovered from the Somme battlefield and to have belonged to Scott came up for auction at Ipswich Sale Room, Loxdale, on May the 13th. Estimated at £300-£500, they sold to an Australian collector of military heritage for £4,600. Scott was born in Elswick, Tyneside. His death as a piper is recorded in the Pipes of War, a record of the achievements of pipers of Scottish and overseas regiments during the war, 1914 to 1918, originally published by the University Press, circa 1920. Chris Elmy of Loxdale said, "The pipes were sold on behalf of a private collector, but had been purchased from the family in recent years. They had looked into donating them, but chose to sell because there is no museum for the Tyneside Scottish, as evidenced by a letter included in the lot. Other personal effects of Scott were included in the lot. As far as we know, Alexander Scott, father of William, kept the pipes of his son who was killed in the action on the first day of the Somme. This was the story told by the family when they were originally sold. The pipes have the correct tartan for the Tyneside Scottish, W.A. Scott's regiment, and Elmy said the overall condition is apt for having been recovered from a battlefield. He added, the fact that a dilapidated set of bagpipes was kept and treasured would indicate sentimental value, so we have no reason to doubt their origin. During the First World War, 100 battalions had more than 2,500 pipers with them. Of these, 500 were killed and 600 wounded." And that was written by Tom Derbyshire. And from music and mayhem, let's move to cars and commerce. This story from page 8 of the Antique Trade Gazette of the 6th of June by Roland Arkell is a little lesson in how to try and get around tax regulations. And it's entitled "Dinky Cars Made Up of Parts in South Africa Add Up to £6,500 Result." South Africa, leaving the Commonwealth in 1961, had serious consequences for British exporters, particularly when withdrawal was followed by imposition of an import tax on luxury goods. Meccano, which sold large numbers of dinky toys to all of the old colonial nations under Commonwealth trade agreements, came up with a solution to bring prices down. As the tax was on finished goods, Meccano experimented with shipping die-cast parts made at the Binns Road factory in Liverpool to South Africa, where the models were assembled and painted locally. A total of 26 models were made in this way between 1962 to 1963, with six more created in 1966 using parts made at the French dinky factory in Bobigny. These South African toys are extremely rare, grail items to serious collectors. It's believed that only one batch of each model was produced. Typically, they're distinguished by unusual colourways, base plates with a gloss rather than a typical matte finish, and, should they survive, boxes with Afrikaans lettering at the one end and printed in South African on the side. As detailed in an amended catalogue description, four of these vehicles emerged for sale at Eubanks in Surrey on May the 20th. Offered together with seven other loose die-cast toys were examples of the Austin Healey Sprite in powder blue, model number 112, a red MG Sports 113, a cream Bentley Series S Coupe 194, and a Jaguar 3.4 Saloon in red, 195. All were in good condition, complete with original boxes, one with a taped repair. Prices of close to £1,000 each are the norm for South African dinky toys in box condition, while the Jaguar Saloon, one of the rarest dinky SA models, has previously sold for more than £2,000. All of this meant the estimate of £100 to £150 for this quartet looked a little lightweight, and so it proved when the lot sold for £6,500, which altogether in Australian dollars is somewhere around £13,000. And that's certainly quite a dinky price. You're listening to the Antiques Radio Show with Jolly and Warwick James on the 2RPH network. And let's start off this section by reminding ourselves of what provenance means. The ATG, that's the Antique Trade Gazette, has put out a glossary of terms on a number of occasions, and here's what they say. Provenance. This term refers to the history of ownership of an object, an item with a long and documented history to a prestigious family or well-known collector, for example, would be said to have good provenance and therefore be more desirable. And relating to that, here's a fascinating piece I came across in the Sydney Morning Herald of the 25th of May, which originally appeared in London's Daily Telegraph. It links provenance to fakes with an interesting slice of history. And this was written by Phoebe Southworth. Fake papers that trapped top Nazi come to light. A fake stamp that led to the capture of leading Nazi Heinrich Himmler has been unearthed 75 years after his death. The SS leader was detained at a checkpoint in northern Germany a few weeks after the World War II had ended in May 1945. Himmler handed over an A4 identity document German soldiers were given at the end of the conflict. His rank was recorded as sergeant and his name as Heinrich Hitzinger, an attempt to conceal his true identity as a key architect of the Holocaust and one of the most wanted Nazis still alive. But after being sent to the British Forces' 31st Civilian Interrogation Camp near Lüneburg, an official stamp of his document was recognised by the soldiers as the same one used by members of the SS who had been trying to evade capture. The whereabouts of the incriminating papers had remained hidden ever since Himmler was finally caught. Now the papers have now been donated to the Military Intelligence Museum in Bedfordshire by the great-niece of Lieutenant Colonel Sidney Noakes, along with the braces Himmler was wearing when he was detained. Noakes, born in 1905, was a lawyer who joined the Intelligence Corps in 1943 and was seconded to the MI5. After the war, he returned to the law, eventually ending up in a judge, and he died in 1993. He's believed to have been one of the MI5's members who interrogated Himmler before his death and was probably given permission to keep the documents by his superiors when any valuable intelligence had been extracted. I can't think of any other way he could have got them, said Bill Stedman, curator of the Military Intelligence Museum. Without this damning stamp on the document, it's possible that Himmler may have been able to pass through the system unnoticed and escape, as did many other Nazis. The Germans themselves made his unmasking an absolute certainty. And thank you, Phoebe Southworth, The Telegraph, London, and the Sydney Morning Herald of the 25th of May. And provenance there was very important in relation to those fake documents. But provenance is only as good as its validity. We don't want to pay a huge premium to own Napoleon's socks unless we're really sure he wore them. It's a little difficult if the vendor says he thinks Napoleon owned them, or in his opinion probably did. And what if the provenance is just a good story? Let's hear the legal angle. And this comes from the Antique Trade Gazette of the 23rd of May, where the lawyer, Milton Silverman, writes, "Can you prove a provenance you put forward? A lawyer writes, historically verifiable ownership is very different from having an opinion. And Milton Silverman goes on, some time ago, a prominent dealer came to see me with a problem. He had entered into a deal to purchase an important painting from another dealer. The decision to purchase had been made consequent on an unbroken chronological provenance contained in the literature provided by the selling dealer promoting the painting. On investigation, this critical provenance was shown to be illusory and unprovable. In these circumstances, my client wanted his money back in exchange for returning the painting. While the final outcome of this matter is confidential, the issues that arose in this case are central to trade in the art world. The argument for my client was as follows. A chronology of historical ownership going back centuries is a simple statement of fact. For example, the well-known picture in the National Portrait Gallery, believed generally by experts to be of Shakespeare, has amongst its provenance ownership by Shakespeare's godson, Sir William Davenant. This is a matter of fact, supporting the belief that the sitter was indeed Shakespeare. So a historical narrative of ownership over a long period of time should be, and was, viewed as a statement of fact by my client. Such a narrative has to be backed up, usually by proper documentation, and is capable of verification. This is very different to where, for example, there are views, often differing, as to the attribution of authorship of a painting. This may very reasonably be a statement of opinion. Then, as long as a dealer or expert truly holds that opinion, the argument runs that he cannot be sued for misrepresentation of his opinion. The present case was very different indeed. The dealer selling had, in our view, misrepresented that the chronological narrative of ownership he was presenting was certain and true, but it was not in any way capable of verification, so the provenance was not a matter of fact. It was merely, it appeared, his opinion that the painting could have been owned by a particular person at a particular time. There is a gulf between an actionable and misrepresentation of fact and a statement of opinion only, such as a view on attribution. Of course, if a dealer lies about his opinion on attribution and says, I believe this painting is by Rembrandt, when he knows perfectly well that his assistant knocked it up yesterday in his studio, then that is another actionable misrepresentation of fact, because the dealer then is misrepresenting that he holds the opinion that the picture is by Rembrandt. So what does all this mean for the art world? Put simply, if you give a historical, dated chronological narrative of facts, unqualified, then that is going to be understood by others as exactly that, a statement of facts, and you will need to be able to verify it. If you only believe a painting might have been owned by someone, then be clear that this is just your opinion and be prepared to explain why you hold that view. It might not add value to your painting, but it will help to keep you out of hot water. And that was written by Milton Silverman, a senior commercial dispute resolution partner at Strathers Solicitors in London, and appeared in the Antique Trade Gazette of the 23rd of May. And still on legal matters, would this little book put you behind bars? And this book review comes from the art newspaper of April. Bill Posters, The Street Art Manual, published by Lawrence King, 144 pages, and costs £14.99. Will this book incur a criminal prosecution? It is an instruction manual on how to make step-by-step street art, aka graffiti, with spray cans of paint, light projections, stenciling, pasting and so on. The publishers say, arm yourself with this guide and go out and reclaim the streets. For whom? Brace yourself for another wave of budding Banksies daubing away on a street near you. So does that incite vandalism? Or is it art? I don't know, but what I do know is we're going to move on to some museum news. A new museum is opening in Sydney, but before we tell you about that, here's some news from abroad. Coupled with a piece of historical information, the article unwittingly reveals. I'll read the piece first. It comes from the art newspaper of April. Under the heading, Top 10 Old Masters. Given the widespread Leonardo hype in and outside the art world on the quincentenary of his death last year, it comes as no surprise that two monographic shows of his drawings at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, New York, and the Queen's travelling exhibition of 80 drawings that peaked in Manchester should make the top 10. It's very likely that the Louvre's recently closed Leonardo show will top the Old Masters category in our 2020 survey. Hype also contributed to a strong turnout at the Rijksmuseum, somewhat misleadingly titled All the Rembrandts, which featured all the museum's works by the Dutch master, not his entire oeuvre. However, all the works came close to being an accurate description of the Bruegel show at Vienna's Kunsthistorisches Museum, which was seen by 3,923 visitors a day. The Prado pulled off a coup with Velasquez's Rembrandt Vermeer exhibition, although there is little evidence that either Velasquez or Rembrandt were even aware of one another's work, and neither would have had a clue about Vermeer. The Spanish show nevertheless presented a number of intriguing comparisons. Now, what is the hidden message in that story which appeared in the April art newspaper? Well, it's in the picture which accompanies the article, which is of some museum goers in the Kunsthistorische Museum in Vienna, looking at a painting. This happens to be The Peasant Dance by Peter Bruegel the Elder and dating from the end of the 1560s. This vibrant painting is of many by Bruegel depicting daily life in Holland. It's of a group of villagers in the open dancing to the accompaniment of a musician, one playing something surprisingly like a set of bagpipes. In the foreground is an energetic peasant and his lady partner. He's wearing a hat and in his hat band is a spoon. Odd, you might think, but not really. At that time, you carried your spoon with you. Where else would you put it if you were dancing? A silver spoon if you were rich, a base metal or wooden spoon if you were the peasant. This all changed around the middle of the 17th century, when hostesses, taverns, and anywhere else you might eat started to provide spoons for you. You didn't have to carry your own. They were provided on the table. And this is the origin of the term the tablespoon. And now we'll dish up the local museum news, coming from Tim Barlas in the Sydney Morning Herald on the 16th of May. And he writes, "The City of Sydney has given the go-ahead for a new museum dedicated to the history of Chinese people in Australia to be built in a former library in the Haymarket." It says the Museum of Chinese in Australia, MOCA, will be a cultural centre and museum space dedicated to the discovery, preservation and promotion of the history of Chinese people. Lord Mayor Clover Moore said moving the city's Haymarket Library branch to a larger space in Darling Square last October presented an opportunity to repurpose the three-storey site at 744 George Street and ensure ongoing community benefit. She said the museum would feature a gallery and exhibition space, programming activities, community spaces for events, an artist-in-residence program, a cafe and a shop. Haymarket is the home of our city's oldest and largest Chinatown, so it's fitting that this is where we will create a centre for the preservation of our Chinese history, Councillor Moore said. The museum will play an important role in promoting and sharing the story of Chinese settlers and their descendants, as well as understanding and celebrating their challenges, contributions and achievements. The Victorian building is in the Venetian Gothic style. It was designed by architect brothers George and Ralph Mansfield and was built in 1875 as a bank. MOCA's proposal was selected from its 13 applications received. MOCA President Dr. John Yu said, "The Chinese community has a deep sense of pride in the growth of Sydney, and it is important we share this with other Australians." Thank you, Tim Barlas. A bit like bagpipes, bells are something you often hear before you see them. That's if you see them at all, but you still know where the sound comes from. But where do they, the bells, actually come from? And here we have a piece from Maeve Kennedy in the art newspaper of May, who helps us find out. Virus shutdown tests Bell Foundry's metal. Loughborough. When in the spring of 2020 the strange hush fell over Britain, the skies and the roads virtually emptied of traffic, and the bustle stilled in the streets, one other element almost disappeared from the soundscape of everyday life: the bells of thousands of churches and public buildings. A few with mechanical hammers still rang, but most were silenced, no longer marking weddings, funerals, or the passing days. Across the world, bells are special. They have names, inscriptions, and histories, and are installed with blessings or special ceremonies. They were so missed that the announcement that Canterbury Cathedral's great bell Harry would ring out over Easter made national news. In Loughborough, Leicestershire, even the town's magnificent carillon, a war memorial for which Edgar Elgar composed a work in 1923, has lost its voice. All its 47 bells, along with those for thousands of churches, including the 17-ton Great Paul for St Paul's Cathedral in London, were cast by a famous local firm, John Taylor's Bell Foundry. Loughborough bells are spread across most Commonwealth countries, as well as the US. One of the most recent, a 6-foot, 5-ton giant, was flown 10,000 miles by the Royal Australian Air Force to Canberra, just before the coronavirus, COVID-19, crisis put an end to international flights. It joins 57 Loughborough bells in the National Carillon, originally a 1970 gift from the UK to Australia. Since the closure in 2017 of the much older Whitechapel Bell Foundry in East London, Taylor's, dating from 1859, has been the last remaining major bell foundry in the UK. It was rescued from administration in 2009 and now is a tenant of the charitable Loughborough Bell Foundry Trust, which owns the site and had just launched a fundraising campaign to safeguard the foundry's future, restoring its decaying Victorian buildings and create a new museum of the history, not just of Taylor's, but of bells in Britain. The operation is now as silent as the bells, thanks to the coronavirus, the machinery meticulously cleaned and oiled before the workers locked the doors and left. And unfortunately, we've got to leave too, because we've run out of time. But Maeve Kennedy's excellent article continues with some details of issues facing the Loughborough Bell Foundry Trust in these difficult times and can be read in full in the art newspaper's May edition. That's all we have time for today on the Antiques Radio Show. If you have any feedback or issues you'd like to raise, please telephone 9518 8811. Or email info@2rph.org.au. I'm Jolyon Warwick James, and I work in the antiques industry. I have developed this program as a volunteer, unrelated to my business.